You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We tend to think of the rise and fall of the great empires throughout history, Mesopotamia, Rome, the Chinese, the Mayans, ours perhaps, as a convergence of politics and luck. But beyond the religious conflicts, the wars, leaders, inventions, and arts, and the ravages of disease, something more basic and universal determines how societies thrive and crumble: their food. And that's the subject of a new book called Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. It's the second collaboration of agricultural expert Evan Fraser and journalist Andrew Remus, and it's published by Free Press. And I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Thanks for having us.
Andrew, I didn't mention Egypt on my list of lost civilizations, but isn't food management the basis of one of the most memorable biblical stories?
Well,
Joseph, we had 7 years of plenty, and then 7 years of famine.
7 years of famine, a story that we use in our book to highlight the importance of food storage and the importance of having a plan for the future and a plan to feed your population beyond the years of plenty.
Well, Evan, when we talk about the rise of societies in terms of their food, are we talking about lucky weather or skilled management?
Well, it's a combination of both. I mean, the story of the Pharaoh having the dream of the seven cows coming out of the Nile to eat the seven fat cows on the edge of the Nile, I mean, and then the Pharaoh deciding to store food, that was an example of good management overcoming the effects of unlucky weather. The problem with, say, the Mayan civilization, for example, is that their management, which actually stripped the areas around their cities of forests, made them more vulnerable to drought. And so when the skies grew clear and the rain clouds scuttered away around the year 800, they had no capacity to manage that problem.
Does the whole story begin in the Fertile Crescent?
It begins in a couple of different places. The Fertile Crescent certainly was one of the first food empires, as we put it. More or less simultaneously, things were starting to get exciting in China. In China, of course, based on rice and millet. And in the Fertile Crescent, wheat was the crop
of choice.
And barley. And barley, of course.
Well, Mesopotamia developed irrigation, which we tend to think of as one of the great gifts of history. But you defined the biggest mistake in history as the shift from hunter-gatherer lifestyles to settled agriculture. What, are you suggesting we should still be out there hunting and gathering?
Well, once we made that choice, we really couldn't go back. Qualitatively, you may live better as a hunter-gatherer. You may live a more comfortable life in terms of work hours put in and less back-breaking labor, but you can't really sustain a population. Also, the geography of the land changed once we started cultivating domestic crops, so that the wild bounty was no longer present.
Well, Freud wrote about this in Civilization and Its Discontents, and he said there was a trade-off.
Indeed, and we made that deal in order to sustain our populations and to have all the wonderful fruits of civilization, such as religion, social differences, art, literature, warfare, what have you.
But it also led to farmers specializing, didn't it?
Indeed, yes, and that is one of the main subjects of our book. We, in order for food empires to grow, people tend to specialize. Geographical areas tend to specialize in particular crops so that they can grow an excess of them and trade them for wealth. One of the problems with specialization is that it tends to lead to very fragile systems. It tends to lead to areas where a single blight can wipe out a crop and leave people hungry. A single crop can leach the land of its nutrients. And specialization is one of the great problems facing us today.
Of course, soil lends itself to certain crops rather than others. So isn't there a trade-off there as well?
Absolutely. This is Evan here from the north of England. And where I'm looking out the window as we speak, I'm looking at beautiful green rolling hills, which is ideal pasture land. And so it would be foolish to think that we should be trying to, that Yorkshire should try to be self-sustaining in, say, its wheat production. It really needs to produce pastured animals and dairy products, because that's what it has a very, very obvious advantage in producing. However, when you extend that logic to a single genetically identical cultivar of wheat for as far as the eye can see, then you've gone past a good idea and into a very serious problem in terms of the fragility of the overall system. And then when you take landscapes that are that homogenous and link them together through trading patterns, what you end up with is a real house of cards where every fragile system is completely dependent on the functioning of every other fragile system to continue, and a single knock in the system can unravel the tapestry of civilization quite dramatically, so history suggests.
Well, we've been talking about monoculture as a problem today, but is this something that goes back to early agricultural practice?
Well, it goes back historically to, enormous number of different historical incidents. One of the more famous ones is the Irish famine. A monoculture there in potatoes resulted in millions of deaths. The monoculture in ancient Sumeria of growing barley ended up destroying the soil and denuding the soil of nutrients and resulting in a loss of productivity and eventually a shift of power and a collapse of the civilization there.
Now, agriculture allows cities to develop. Has the idea of a city been a hindrance to feeding people?
Evan, do you want to feel that one?
Well, isn't it really, really interesting question there. I mean, the basis of the city is the surplus food that the farmer doesn't actually need. And so the city depends entirely and is entirely reliant on the farmers producing a surplus, the farmers then being able to store that surplus for long enough in order to get to the city, and the farmers having some mechanism to trade that surplus into the urban marketplaces. And without those three things, you don't get cities. Without cities, you don't really get the sort of cultural developments that we enjoy today, and you don't get the sort of flowering of artistic and intellectual endeavors that you see it, that sort of are seen often as the high watermarks of human endeavor.
And beyond cities, if you're going to become an empire, you have to go, you have to trade the food. You don't just produce the food. For example, weren't the Sumerians doing that?
Right. They traded mostly for copper. They had a thriving copper trade
to the Indus Valley across the Indian Ocean from the Fertile Crescent. There was an extraordinarily vibrant trade of wheat and barley out of Sumeria and copper coming into it, such that the Sumerians had a very vibrant artistic life based around copper, but they had no local supplies of copper themselves at all.
The Chinese did the same thing with jade and some of the other things they valued. Wasn't China also developing agriculture around the same time? And were they in any way connecting to the people of the Fertile Crescent?
Well, I'm sure that trade relations have gone back so far that you can see evidence of goods shifting across entire continents. For instance, China, there's evidence of wheat arriving in China at a very early time when wheat is not a native plant in China. So it was obviously brought there by someone with an interest in transporting it for presumably a commercial reason.
The Silk Road existed long before the Romans came along.
And food was a major part of the trade?
Yes, absolutely.
My guests are Evan D.G. Fraser and Andrew Remus. Their book, Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations, is published by Free Press. How much can we learn about a civilization from what people were eating? For example, the Romans. Was their diet similar to what we think of as the modern Mediterranean diet?
That's
your question, Andrew.
Well, in a way it was. I mean, they subsisted primarily on bread, which modern Mediterraneans do not. Modern Mediterraneans do have a larger variety. But the Romans did eat a lot of olive oil. They couldn't survive on bread alone because, obviously, you become nutritionally deficient very quickly. So they got vitamins from olive oil and from a type of processed fish sauce called garum, which they brewed in tremendous quantities in factories around their empire. And those, for a typical urban peasant, would have been the main staples. It would be different types of bread with fish sauce and olive oil.
And were these locally produced?
Not at all, necessarily. They were often produced in tremendous plantations and then shipped across the length of the empire. The bread itself was very frequently produced on the peripheries of the empire. Italy, stopped being able to feed itself fairly early on within late in the Republican period. And the city of Rome was famously dependent on shipments of Egyptian grain. They needed to import the food to feed themselves because their own hinterland had lost the capacity to do so.
And one of the more lively issues you bring up in this book is piracy and Roman grain.
Yes.
Well, Romans promised, wasn't every citizen promised an allotment of grain? So that was a major part of the culture.
Well, very much so, yes. It was a public handout. It was a public fund for the citizens within the city themselves. And governments knew that they needed to keep this up. They needed to keep up the social security payments in order to avoid political unrest. So it became a political issue that was upset when piracy started to interrupt the grain shipments.
And where were these pirates coming from?
Well, they were coming from all the hidden coves and ports in the eastern part of the Mediterranean, and they were very organized, very wealthy, very lethal, so much so that they became kind of a trope within Roman literature even. There was so much of a nuisance and so much of a political threat that the Romans needed to pass a law to grant tremendous military and political powers to Pompey the Great in order to wipe them out.
And what did the pirates do with their plundered grain?
Well, I believe sometimes they would hold it for ransom. I'm not entirely sure of the specifics.
So nothing has changed. If they were Somalis, they'd be holding it for the same kind of ransom.
I imagine so. There is a nice little historical link you can make there.
Evan, we think of the Romans as innovators of roads, armies, architecture, but just as significant as a gift to future empires were their food storage buildings. Didn't they come up with huge versions of silos?
Yeah, well, the Romans faced an enormous logistical challenge having to get a grain harvest, largely that came from the Nile Basin and was produced once a year, and get that into Rome, the city of Rome. So they managed to construct, across the empire, a series of very sophisticated grain silos. And grain's not an easy thing to store at length. You have to keep it above certain temperatures and below other temperatures and at different levels of humidity to prevent rot from storing. You also have to keep it well buffered from rodents and insects. At any rate, so they built vast horaria, these grain warehouses, throughout the empire, and especially at the port city of Ostia, which is just outside of Rome and is where all of the food had to flow into the empire. And these are sort of gargantuan, stadium-sized kind of constructions that kept the grain over the 12-month period while the people needed to eat it.
We tend to think of the fall of the Roman Empire as being due to the convergence of weak leaders and outside invaders, political problems. Was food management just another burden in a difficult era, or was there more of a cause and effect at play here?
Well, it's a really good one. Certainly, the inability, the fact that the Romans, as they expanded, tend to over farm their soil, was one reason that they had to continue to expand further and further and further, ever in search of more and more fertile grain fields. And so one of the causes for expansion and ultimately overexpansion politically for the Roman Empire was its need for more and more amounts of food. And this was exacerbated actually by climate. And the Romans at their peak enjoyed what's called by climatologists the Roman warm period, where temperatures were pretty good, pretty much like they were in the 1970s and 1980s, if you look at sort of average temperature graphs going back 2,000 years for Europe. But then the Roman warm period came to an end, and it cooled to a much less pleasant, much shorter growing season period of time that stretched somewhere between 300 and 400, so when it started, then about 1,000 AD. And at this period of time, then these overtaxed Roman fields that were already under a fair bit of pressure due to the demand of the cities actually started becoming less productive because of climate. And that created an acceleration, or that accelerated the speed of the decline.
Hasn't it also been hypothesized that lead poisoning was a reason for the decline and fall of Rome?
Yeah, we have to be really careful here. We have to be very careful of single explanations for something as complex as the fall of a society. And certainly the health of the elite is one major hypothesis as to why the Roman Empire stumbled and fell when it did. Another component of that tapestry is, however, problems that emerged in their food production and distribution system, which were exacerbated by the climate change at the time.
And I would say it's telling that, I believe it was by the 4th century, there had been an effort to switch taxation from money to grain, so that the government demanded citizens pay taxes in grain as opposed to coin.
It usually is the other way around.
Exactly.
We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about this book, Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. Bring it up to more recent times. My guests are Andrew Remus and Evan D.G. Fraser. The book is published by Free Press. Stay with us. We're back with Evan D.G. Fraser and Andrew Remus, who've collaborated on Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. It's published by Free Press. Your second collaboration?
That's right. We first worked on a book called Beef, The Untold Story of How Milk, Meat, and Muscle Changed the World. Shaped the world.
Let's bring this up to the New World. In the 1400s and 1500s, when Europe began colonizing the New World, were they just looking for a way to obtain spices, as I was taught in high school, or was there something going on with the land back home? Was there more soil depletion of the sort that the Romans had experienced earlier?
Well, yes, the population in Europe had bounced back from a low point during the Black Death and afterwards. And population increases had again driven labor costs or labor wages down and the price of food up. So there was increasing incentive within Europe to look for new avenues for employment.
Could the Europeans have done anything to keep their own continent viable?
Well, given the level of agricultural technology in the 1600s, they probably were doing pretty much as good as they could do, by and large. That said, places in like the Netherlands, for example, they were really starting to innovate, not by sending people outward, so they were doing a bit of that too, but they were really at the forefront of developing new modern types of agricultural technology, fertilizing the soil, recycling nutrients, developing new breeds of cows and things like that. And so in the Netherlands, you see sort of an explosion of agricultural innovation, but the main impetus behind exploring the New World was obviously the Spanish and the Portuguese, and they were very much facing very serious subsistence crisis, where the supply of food simply wasn't meeting the demand of the communities at that point.
Wasn't China facing similar problems, but choosing a different way to deal with it?
Yeah, it was. I mean, there's a strong argument amongst Chinese historians that at precisely the same time, Britain and Europe and China were facing a similar, what's known as an ecological crisis, where simply they were struggling to keep themselves fed. And one of the key symptoms of this was bad inflation across all of Eurasia. And this again coincides with the trough of what's known as the Little Ice Age. So there was a very bad period of weather in around 1600 to 1650 that exacerbated this problem all across Eurasia. And the Chinese, rather than expanding outwards, actually decided to sort of invest inwards, drove their peasants harder, squeezed a little bit more blood from the stone, but did not look outwards to their exterior frontier, but looked inwards to try to intensify their agriculture.
Well, some of the heroes of the story in Europe were the members of various monasteries, weren't they? I know that they're credited with making major advances in winemaking, but weren't they also involved in agriculture?
Well, that was a little bit earlier that the European monasteries pushed the peripheries of civilization back out of the nadir during what we call the Dark Ages and brought the economic life of Europe back up during the High Middle Ages. And that was really a period of tremendous expansion agriculturally. The monks they followed a pattern. They went into unclaimed or possibly claimed by wild tribes, but they went into wild lands on the peripheries of Europe, clear-cut forests, and created towns and industry based around hard work and agriculture.
But even later, you wind up with someone like Gregor Mendel and his experiments with pea plants that changed the course of agricultural history, didn't they?
Yeah, so starting in around 9-1000, the monks start establishing, or the monasteries provide sort of an institutional framework or a societal structure, something, some sort of clubhouse for people to get together, and that protects themselves from the sort of the crazy chaos that's going on outside, politically speaking, and allows them to do things like start tinkering with agricultural products, crop rotation, better plows, these sort of very mundane-sounding things that actually provided that boost of food that allowed society to become wealthy enough to build something like Notre Dame Cathedral. So we're talking then by the 1100s. And yeah, that tradition of agricultural innovation that was established in the monastic communities does indeed continue as a thread all the way through to the 20th century and those early experiments in plant genetics you just mentioned. But where they really play the pivotal role is sort of between 9 and 1100, where the monks start to take on the characteristics of a modern agribusiness, where they have monopolies on retail, they have monopolies on production, they own all the good technology, and as a result of that, they become extremely powerful, extremely wealthy, but in doing so, create enough food to create a society that's wealthy enough to, like I just said, build Notre Dame Cathedral.
But Gregor Mendel, for example, later develops a technology of plant seed manipulation that carries on to this day. And I get the feeling that you're saying it's a mixed bag.
Well, agricultural innovation has generally been a good thing. But what we do warn about in our book is an over-reliance on technological fixes to continue feeding us in the future.
Well, up until now, we've had a situation where if crops fail in one area, there's always we can always go somewhere else. For a long time, when the Soviet Union was having serious problems, they relied on their biggest enemy, the United States, to supply them with wheat.
Yeah, and that's still happening today, thank goodness. I mean, for example, just this week, China decided to double its imports of Canadian wheat this year to overcome a deficit in the North China Plain that's been experiencing some bad drought conditions. And so when things work well, the international trading agreements really do provide a buffer against these sort of regional problems, a regional shock. What happens, however, is when you get very poor people and very rich people all in the same marketplace competing for the same food that's flowing around, then you get some really, really perverse and crazy things happening. So when a series of El Nino droughts hit the Victorian era period in the southern Asia, it wasn't that there wasn't enough food in India, it's that the consumers in India that had lost their crops weren't able to compete with the consumers in, say, London that were then buying the Indian crops that were there. And so you have these extremely... the problem with the market in this case is you've got these extremely asymmetrical relationships where you've got some poor people and some rich people all trying to buy the same kind of food, the same amount of food. If it's a big country, then that's okay. So China's rich enough to be able to pull food into it to overcome deficits. But a place like Ethiopia simply isn't.
Well, this is the justification for imperialism, isn't it? If you can't grow enough yourself, then you go somewhere else and you have it grown there and then you bring it back home. Screw the people who are producing the stuff.
Well, that's precisely what the Romans did.
And the Victorian England. And in each of these cases, it led to a system that was inherently very fragile to problems. It was inherently became politically unstable, as the Romans witnessed. It was environmentally unstable because it was relied on these landscapes, these vast landscapes that were extremely specialized and tied together with these trade arrangements. And ultimately, it became very fragile houses of cards, such that when a political problem coincided with an environmental problem, it simply couldn't. These systems simply couldn't sustain themselves.
My guests are Evan D.G. Fraser, an adjunct professor of geography at the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada, and a senior lecturer at the School of Earth and Environment at the University of Leeds in the U.K., and Andrew Remus, a managing editor at the Improper Bostonian magazine, previously an associate editor and staff writer at the Boston magazine. They've collaborated on a couple of books, the most recent one, Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations, which is published by Free Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Haven't the so-called miracle seeds that we've been hearing about more recently been developed to protect farmers against the kind of disaster that we've seen in the past?
Well, indeed they have, and they've done a wonderful job at increasing yields. But one of the problems that's inherent within them is expense. And what we are seeing is that very often the seeds are tied to expensive fertilizers and are tied to they cost a great deal of money to create and to grow.
Whenever we talk about this, the name Monsanto comes up. Are they the major developers and marketers of the fertilizers and pesticides and seeds that are needed for all of this agriculture?
Well, Monsanto is an interesting beast in this regard, because you're right, it does get painted as the great villain. And to many extent, they have done a lot of very negative things, especially for poor farmers in the developing world. For example, they own the patents on the seed types and the pesticides and the fertilizers, and tend to sell these as quite expensive packages to farmers. That said, just in the last year, Monsanto has been developing drought-resistant strains of grains and have been working with the Gates Foundation to distribute that technology, those seed technologies, free in Africa. And so, you know, even something as big and monolithic as an agri-corporate business, you know, they can learn and are responsive to a degree to public scrutiny and protest.
The European Union plans to allow its member countries to decide whether or not they can grow genetically modified crops, the so-called Frankenfoods. What effects come from either maintaining or lifting bans on biotech products?
Well, one of the key things that I'm concerned about is the majority of biotechnology is focused, as Andrew just said, on increasing yields, on creating super productive cultivars of grain in particular. Now, that's fine. However, to grow these enormous abundant quantities, they also need enormous abundant quantities of water and enormous abundant quantities of fertilizer, and fertilizer is completely related to fossil fuel use, because you need a tremendous amount of natural gas to produce nitrogen fertilizer. And so my main concern with as we lift the moratoriums or give countries the ability to say yes to these sorts of technologies, that the short-term goal of boosting yields will blinker people to the long-term issues of soil management, of water sustainable water management, and ultimately link our agricultural system even more closely to the fossil fuel industry. And as most of us are expecting, the fossil fuel industry probably will not be existing in the same form as it does today and has for the last 50 years into the next 50 years.
It's really hard to overstate our reliance on fossil fuels within agriculture. Very often people think, of course, we rely on them for every aspect of our lives, but we really do rely on them for the food we eat, just to grow
produce it and to deliver it.
Of course, for every aspect of the network and the food empire. And as the fuel prices increase, we are going to see that directly filter into prices of everything, but particularly of food.
But it's part of the whole change in preventing. Well, one of the big problems is the decaying of food, and because of fossil fuels, we've been able to transport food further distances without it decaying. We've developed refrigeration. There was a time when if we were lucky, we had ice.
Yes.
So, you know, all of this sounds to me like there's a trade-off.
It is. It is a system in which we have largely traded our dependence on the natural bounty of the earth for the natural bounty of our oil wells. And we are now very much tied. We have a population of 6 billion, quickly growing to 9 billion. These people wouldn't exist for the most part if it weren't for our modern agricultural fixes.
And I wouldn't have orange juice in the morning.
Precisely.
An article.
Well, more than that, you probably wouldn't have arms and legs. I mean, our bodies at the cellular level are built on proteins that come from nitrogens that were synthesized in chemical factories. So at a cellular level, everybody we meet these days in the Western worlds, bodies are made out of nitrogen that comes out of factories as opposed to comes out of the soil. Which is a very profound statement about how tightly linked we are to this oil-soaked system.
So does this suggest that we're going to see a decline and fall of our civilization, which is more like a global civilization now, the global empire, than any single country's empire, because of this? Or are we going to be able to make adjustments?
Well, the 21st century is really going to be the century of competition with resources, and food is inherently one of the most fundamental products tied to our resources. Yes, we are going to see increasing scarcity and increasing problems, most likely. The question on how to fix that and how to possibly meet those challenges can best be met through more sustainable practices.
Well, there are also cultural differences. An article in the New York Times yesterday cited the Netherlands as a country that favors genetically modified crops, while Austria is one that doesn't. And I'm assuming that that has to do with all sorts of other historical imperatives.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think the question of historical imperatives clearly fascinates Andrew and I because we just wrote a book about it. I think our society, the way we feed ourselves, bears a lot of very striking and very profound similarities with the way the Romans fed themselves before the Roman Empire fell, before how the Mayans fed themselves before the Mayans fell, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. However, we aren't an ancient society, and there are also very profound differences. Getting back to your comment right at the beginning about the pharaoh and his grain supply and having the dream from God that predicted the fact the famine was coming. The ancients had no way of anticipating the future except by divine revelation. We, however, can do a pretty good job at predicting the future, and I know our climate models are not perfect, and our demographic and population models aren't perfect, and certainly our economic models aren't perfect, but we have pretty good tools, much better than previous societies, to anticipate these problems in advance, and we have phenomenal technological tools in order to take steps to try to meet them. However, our concern is that as we develop more yield-boosting genetically modified organisms and invest more and more heavily in a refrigerator-based transportation system and a market-based economic system, we are actually extending or increasing the similarities between our society and the ancient Romans, not actually taking the preventative steps such that the bad times don't ruin us.
Evan D.G. Fraser and Andrew Remus, their book, Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. It's published by Free Press. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you very much indeed.